NPR's Throughline podcast sort of feels like stepping into a time machine. Each episode, our Peabody Award-winning show travels beyond the headlines to answer the question, how did we get here? Listen to one of Apple's favorite podcasts of 2024 by searching for Throughline on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app.
Followers everywhere are praying for Pope Francis to recover. In Argentina,
tengo la vela donde dice amor con amor se paga.
They're also praying he'll come home. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, why Pope Francis hasn't made that trip yet. Also, where Vladimir Putin stands on a possible ceasefire.
He says he supports the conceptual idea of a ceasefire, but the devil's going to be in the details.
Plus, why scientists think airplane bathrooms might be the place to identify future pandemics.
You can say, look, on this flight, we got the introduction of that pathogen.
Plus, cool new ocean species just discovered.
They actually have these big flamboyant wings, these very soft wings that they use to float through the water.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Abemus Papam.
12 years ago today in Rome, Father Jorge Bergoglio was installed as Pope Francis.
Sancte Romani Ecclesiae Cardinalem Bergoglio.
The first pope from Latin America. Since then, he's made dozens of international trips, but he has not gone back to his home of Argentina.
Now that the 88-year-old pontiff is in the hospital with double pneumonia, some of his followers are starting to wonder if that'll ever happen. They're hoping that he will somehow still make a papal visit. Natalia Cosoy brings us a story from Argentina's capital.
It's a very hot and humid evening in Buenos Aires, and yet dozens of people have braved the weather carrying candles to meet here in front of the columns of the Buenos Aires Cathedral to pray for the health of Pope Francis.
Me acuerdo que estaba en casa, que muchos periodistas decían que ni loco, que ni iba a ser ni nada.
César holds a thick candle and is standing together with some friends. He still remembers the day Pope Francis was named. Some journalists had said it was impossible. He says they celebrated at his house as if Argentina had scored a goal in the World Cup. Teresa also came to pray for the Pope.
Tengo la vela donde dice amor con amor se paga.
She says, I've got a candle with the inscription, love is repaid with love.
Por eso con mi amor le pagaré a mi papa hermoso.
She sings, that is why I will pay you with my love, my beautiful Pope. But in this relationship between Francis and his Argentine followers, something is missing.
Tonight, the first pope from the Americas is in the United States for the first time in his life.
Chilean Catholics and immigrants from many parts of Latin America spent the night here for the chance to see Pope Francis up close.
From the moment of his arrival in Rio, Pope Francis has been hands-on, opening his window and his arms to countless Catholics who have...
Even though he has traveled to more than 60 countries as pontiff, he never returned to Argentina.
Sí, yo me quedé con ganas, sí, la verdad que sí.
I was left wanting, says Teresa, in front of the cathedral, wearing a simple light blue short-sleeved clergy shirt, is Father Gastón Colombres. He's in charge of a parish in one of Buenos Aires' shanty towns. Pope Francis had dedicated himself to the poor, and they feel very close to him. Father Colombres says they had hoped for the Pope to visit Argentina. He says, we all prayed and asked for him to come. We even carried out some sort of campaign saying, come Francis, your people are waiting for you. And well, we're still waiting. Hopefully he can recover and visit at some point. But why is it that having traveled so much, even to countries neighboring Argentina like Brazil, Paraguay and Bolivia, he never set foot in his motherland since becoming pope? Loris Zanatta is a history professor at Bologna University in Italy who has specialized in Latin America and published a recent political biography of Jorge Bergoglio.
Papa Francisco de viajar en la Argentina habría imaginado un
He says that if Pope Francis were to travel to Argentina, he would have envisioned a triumphant journey, one that unites Argentinians and connects them with faith and the papacy. However, Sanata argues that in reality, Pope Francis is acutely aware that nowhere else in the world is he as divisive as he is in Argentina. He says the Pope is closely associated with Peronism, a popular, or depending on who you ask, populist political party. The Pope's divisiveness is confirmed by social research in Argentina. Fortunato Malimasi is a sociologist who has been studying religion in the country for decades.
La figura de Bergoglio fue es una figura ambivalente, cuestionada por algunos, apreciada por otros.
Malimasi's research shows that a third of Argentines appreciate the Pope for being the Argentine pontiff. Another third, who are Catholic, reject what he represents because of his perceived closeness to politics and his criticism of capitalism. And the final third, who in many cases are not even Catholic, value his positions on human rights. So why does Malimasi think Pope Francis didn't visit Argentina?
Creo que ha considerado que tenía que tomar distancia de...
He says, I believe he has felt the need to distance himself from the various political parties or groups within Argentine society, and that after 12 years of being a popular and beloved figure worldwide, especially among the poorest and more marginalized sectors, coming to Argentina would mean returning to all that past, which he may feel is not entirely resolved. Back outside the cathedral, I ask Father Colombres why he thinks Francis has not traveled to Argentina. The truth is, it's a mystery, he says. But knowing Francis, adds Father Colombres, I believe it's more a conviction that today he is the father of the entire world, that he has to accompany the whole world. And in Argentina, he has already shown what he felt God asked of him. César believes there is still a chance.
Ojalá su salud se cure y ojalá pueda estar en Argentina.
I hope his health recovers, he says, and I hope he can be in Argentina. But for me, spiritually, he's already here. For the world, I'm Natalio Cosoy, Buenos Aires.
Just your ID and your ticket, please, and then you take it on the phone down on this glass bar.
Earlier this week, I went to the airport, not to get on a plane, but for science. During the height of the COVID pandemic, testing wastewater was a fairly new way to track the spread of the virus. Since then, that kind of testing has expanded all around the globe. And now a team of researchers argues testing wastewater from airplanes at select sentinel sites strategically located around the world could help detect new pathogens faster. Alessandro Bespignani, a professor at Northeastern University, is part of that team here in Boston. I met up with him on location to hear how it works. We are here at Boston's International Airport. We're standing near the TSA security line where people are going through, about to get on their airplanes. Tell me why you think planes that land at a place like this have an advantage for identifying the spread of viruses early.
Well, you know, we, the people, are the spreader of diseases. We are also the carrier of disease. And so if you go back with your memory to the early days of COVID-19, one of the problems is that we thought, okay, we don't have people coming from China because we closed the border. There is no travel from there. While instead the cases and the infections were flying into the U.S. from many other countries, and there were a lot of undetected spreading. So we want really to not be blindsided the next time, and we want to have a way to anticipate when a pathogen is introduced in a country. And the introduction points are airports. This is where millions of people that can carry diseases can get into the country.
So tell me how this works. A plane lands here, as they're doing, every few minutes. Then what happens so you can understand what's going on with the wastewater there?
Think about an infected person with a pathogen that boards a plane. During the flight, that person goes to the bathroom, and leaves a trace of the pathogen in the sewer of the plane. When the plane lands, somebody is going to take a sample of the sewage water that then is discharged and cleaned from the airplane and then sent to a lab. This lab does genomic screening and can get all the list of pathogens that are in that sample and eventually signal the introduction of something that is a threat. When you have a hit, at that point you can say, look, on this flight or at this airport, we got the introduction of that pathogen. Now other sentinels across the world do the same work. And if you see different hits in different sentinel airports, you can start to triangulate, identify where the virus come or pathogen, general pathogens comes from, and the characteristic of that pathogen.
So why airplanes specifically, the wastewater from airplanes and not airports or another physical location?
In an airplane, you can identify not just that the pathogen is coming into the country, but also, okay, from which route? You can go back and test the sample that you have accumulated in time, and eventually, if there is something completely new, understand when it got first in the country. But we are still working on it. So this is still something that is being set up. Several countries are testing this approach. The best way to envision this approach is to have international collaborations.
How has wastewater monitoring for viruses evolved since the early days of the pandemic? Has it become more widespread? And are countries monitoring for other things besides COVID?
Well, it was not used that much before COVID. Instead, you know, COVID was a kind of battleground testing of those technologies that worked in the end. And so environmental wastewater is now used in several countries to monitor the prevalence and incidence of the disease. And it has been tested the generalization to other pathogens like the flu and other possible threats, health threats to the population.
I imagine wastewater testing is expensive. Is there a concern about there being a budget for this kind of thing, for the expansion of this into a real program or cuts to existing wastewater surveillance that the CDC is already doing?
These are expensive programs scientifically, but, you know, this is like buying your insurance toward another pandemic event. And believe me, these are little fraction in terms of what we spend for many, many other things. So this is a very good investment if we want to have a country that is better prepared, monitoring, and better aware of all the possible pathogen threats across the world.
It has been 5 years this week since the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic, and it strikes me that places like this, like airports, were completely silent for months. Travel seems to have returned to normal here today. I'm wondering if this mile marker and being in this place makes you reflect on anything, where we've come in the last 5 years, either professionally or more personally.
Well, personally, every time I think about quiet airports with no one in it, it's like reliving the trauma of those days. And it's also a kind of motivation for the work that we are doing. We don't want that to happen again. We want to be in a position where we are not blindsided by any pathogen or virus. We want to have monitoring systems that are timely, ready, and can tell us, okay, there is a situation and we can have actionable insight on what to do.
Are we not there yet? Have we not learned that lesson from the pandemic, 5 years of pandemic?
The CDC is building the equivalent of a national weather forecast for pathogens to try to have reliable forecast and outlook on what could be the health threats for our country. But there is need of political will. There is need of resources. There is need of the population buying into the idea. And so we need to be prepared.
Alex, thank you so much for this conversation and for coming out to the airport with us.
Thank you very much.
Alessandro Vespignani is a professor at Northeastern University who studies computational epidemiology, talking with me there about wastewater monitoring at airports. We have more reporting and stories about the fifth anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic online at theworld.org.
Meanwhile, outbreaks of another disease are alarming public health officials in several countries, measles. We'll take a global look at how it's spreading just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the U.S., outbreaks of measles have caused alarm, with more than 200 cases reported just in this year, mostly in Texas. Globally, last year, more than 10 million people were infected with measles. That's from an estimate by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Countries like Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India were the most affected. Peter Hotez is a pediatrician and a professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. We got him on the line today to ask whether we're likely to see a rise in cases worldwide.
Yeah, I'm worried that we're seeing a 1-2 punch globally. So the first punch was some of the social disruptions and diversion of resources because of COVID. So it interrupted some of the childhood vaccination programs, and that affected caused rises in multiple childhood infections, measles, pertussis, even polio. Measles is usually the first one you see because it's so highly transmissible. So that's kind of our biomarker if we're having problems with vaccination programs. So that's the first punch. And then the second punch is the anti-vaccine movement that's mostly being exported now from the United States. It's now gaining a foothold in low and middle income countries on the African continent, even in Latin America, which for decades has sort of held the line and prevented the anti-vaccine movement from the U.S. I am very worried about an unraveling of this, and especially now with the U.S. pulling out of the World Health Organization. I've met a few times with Dr. Tedros, the head of the World Health Organization, about the fact that the U.S. is exporting its anti-vaccine movement and having big-time impacts.
Well, I mean, you make a point there, because measles was declared eliminated from the U.S. by the WHO 25 years ago. It was attributed to the success of vaccination efforts. So when you look at where we're seeing measles outbreaks across the globe, is there a correlation between those outbreaks and vaccination rates?
Oh, no question. And the problem is the bar is pretty high. In order to stop measles transmission, you need high levels of herd immunity. That means roughly 90-95% of your cohort of kids needs to be immunized. The key is to get that high level of vaccination. And as that falters, measles is often the first breakthrough infection that we see. So it is a sign that we're in trouble.
Mm.
You know, prior to exporting our anti-vaccine movement, the times where we really started to see significant measles epidemics were in times of conflict where you were interrupting measles control efforts. That explains what we saw in Yemen. It explains what we saw during the ISIS occupation in Iraq and Syria. You know, we saw this in northern Nigeria because of Boko Haram, and of course in South Sudan. You know, war and conflict is a big driver of this.
There are obviously other disease outbreaks around the globe, like cholera, typhoid, polio. I'm just wondering how measles compares to the other diseases I mentioned in terms of its public health threat.
They're all public health threats, but measles, the one you worry about is the numbers, just because it's so highly transmissible in the way it can race through a population. So among an unvaccinated population, measles can infect 90% of those individuals. So if you line up 10 individuals who are unvaccinated, typically children, expose them to the measles virus, 9 will acquire it. And so the numbers go very high. And when those numbers go high, bad things start to happen. And we've already had 2 measles deaths here in our Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma epidemic. We got used to not seeing it since it was eliminated in 2000, and now we realize that it's a very serious infection and still very much with us because of our anti-vaccine movement here in Texas.
Dr. Peter Hotez is the director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston.
Bangladeshi politician Saifuzzaman Chowdhury built a global multi-million-dollar real estate empire on a salary of $13,000 a year.
I have the best property in downtown. I have near Dubai Mall in Oprah. I have a very penthouse, nice penthouse. But I also bought a villa with private lagoon and everything. It's very nice.
That's him bragging about his properties to undercover journalists from Al Jazeera. Chaudhry was a minister under the country's now deposed leader, Sheikh Hasina. He's accused of stealing from government coffers, and the new government wants the money back. Transparency International Bangladesh has investigated this case. Executive Director Iftikhar Zaman in Dhaka says politicians there have embezzled a lot of money.
Well, it is estimated to be 3.4% of the GDP.
Wow.
And in other words, it is estimated to be at least double the amount of total foreign direct investment in Bangladesh, as well as foreign development assistance taken together. So it's a huge amount of money, in term, not only in terms of volume, but in terms of impact on the economy.
Can you give us a sense of what that money was supposed to be used for? Can you draw a direct line between the money that disappeared and, you know, social services that weren't delivered or big infrastructure projects that weren't built?
Well, the obvious thing is that this money is public money. It's money of the people of Bangladesh, and they were supposed to be in Bangladesh, invested in Bangladesh for Bangladesh economy, whether as business or as a public infrastructure, as education, health, and other public services in a country which, of course, has done pretty well in terms of socioeconomic growth, but these resources are so badly needed for development and social change. These have been lost for the economy, have been laundered out of the country.
So now the new government in Bangladesh wants to get some of this money that was taken by Chaudhry and other officials back. How are they trying to make that happen?
Well, first of all, this is a very long and arduous and difficult process because of the legal obligations. I may just mention, for example, that globally, now, the amount of money that are transferred illicitly out of developing countries to the developed world, only 1% of the total amount in general are actually brought back. So the success rate is very, very low. And also it takes a long process on an average 5 to 7 years. I am not saying that this is, in our case, it will be also limited to 1% or it will take 5 to 7%, because there is a situation in Bangladesh which is, thanks to the transformation that has taken place with the fall of the authoritarian regime, the international community, countries like UK, USA, are favorably disposed to assist and cooperate with Bangladesh authorities, which has actually started, and we do hope that some certain amount of money can be brought back.
Of course, Chaudhry, as you mentioned, was not the only person doing this embezzling. $16 billion a year was embezzled during Sheikh Hasina's regime. Do we know how many people were responsible for that? How many Chaudhrys are out there?
By now, the Anti-Corruption Commission and the other investigating agencies have started an investigation against at least more than 100 people. All of them are very high profile, and their families also, family of the former prime minister, family members, including her daughter and her son and her sister's children, etc. So it's a large number of people. The challenge for the interim government and the government that will take over after the election, which is hopefully due by the end of the year or early next year, is to start the process and set a few examples that corruption is a punishable offense. Illicit transfer is a punishable offense, and then they are to be held to account and bring back your money and pay for what you have done in terms of stealing the state properties and public money. I'm saying this because it's a long, long process. We can't expect things to happen in short term.
Iftikhar Zaman of Transparency International Bangladesh. He headed an anti-corruption commission for the new government. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We have seen slow, shaky steps toward a ceasefire in Ukraine this week. This afternoon, indication from Moscow that Russian President Vladimir Putin is willing to consider a U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire. That proposal also got conditional support from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Caveats all over the place, though, and still very few details on the plan. Dmitry Alperovich is a political analyst and author of World on the Brink.
Well, we don't have the details, but it looks like it's just an unconditional ceasefire for 30 days in the ground, air, and sea domain. And that's what the Ukrainians have agreed on, of course, with the U.S. side back in Saudi Arabia earlier this week. And they're now presenting that to Putin.
So how would you characterize Vladimir Putin's response today to that plan?
Well, as expected, he didn't want to reject it out of hand. He didn't want to upset Donald Trump and potentially jeopardize the larger price that he's looking at now, which is not just what happens with Ukraine, but the potential for the normalization of the U.S. and Moscow relationship and potentially getting rid of sanctions, potentially doing joint projects in the Arctic and elsewhere, and really trying to drive more of a wedge between Europe and the United States that he's been very pleased to see over the last couple of weeks. So as a result of that, he needs to show that he is going to try to play along and accomplish Donald Trump's objective here, which is to try to bring this war to a close. But of course, it comes with a lot of buts and conditions. And that's exactly what you saw him say today, which is that he likes the idea. It's a good idea. But there are a lot of nuances to work through. One of the main ones is, of course, what happens to the Ukrainian forces that are still in the Russian Kursk Oblast that they had invaded back in August. And they've been steadily losing territory, particularly this week, but they're still in that part of the Russian region. He is indicating that he clearly wants them all out and gone before he signs on to a ceasefire. And then secondly, he's talking about broader issues about Ukraine potentially getting weapons during the course of the ceasefire, engaging in training of their personnel, and he will try and negotiate away those points as well.
Is there anything specific that Putin says that he does agree to within this plan?
Well, he says he supports the conceptual idea of a ceasefire and potentially getting on a path to peace negotiations. But the devil is going to be in the details. And he clearly sees this as an opening for much more negotiations with the United States. They're covering not just Ukraine, but the broader bilateral relationship. And in fact, his advisor Ushakov said today that with the Trump envoy Witkoff coming to Moscow today, they're not just talking about Ukraine. They're talking about broader U.S.-Russia relationship.
So remind us of what Ukraine has said that it agrees to or doesn't agree to, and if there's any overlap between what Russia and Ukraine both agree to.
Well, Ukraine just agreed to, very reluctantly, I must say, to a total ceasefire for 30 days with no conditions attached to it. Now Russia is going to be asking for conditions.
So what is the next step here? Whose court is the ball in right now?
Well, as we're speaking, Putin is supposed to be meeting with Witkoff to get more into those details. Putin also said that he plans to have a conversation with Donald Trump directly on this. He wants to engage his negotiation teams with American negotiation teams. So I expect that this is a process that's going to drag out, not just for days, but potentially even weeks, before we get to any sort of resolution about whether there will be a ceasefire or not in this conflict.
And where does this back and forth between Washington and Moscow leave Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's president?
Well, ultimately, he's going to have to decide what is going to be acceptable to him and to his country. And the reality is that I think the two sides, Russia and Ukraine, are still very, very far apart on an eventual peace deal. But even getting a 30-day ceasefire, I think, would ultimately be good for Ukraine. It would give them a chance to get a reprieve, get some rest for their troops, potentially train more folks and build fortifications to improve their defensive lines.
Dmitry Alperovich is a political analyst and author of World on the Brink.
Versace, the name alone conjures a whole vibe synonymous with glamour, luxury, and bold fashion design. The face of the company for the last three decades is also memorable. High cheekbones, heavy eye makeup, and of course, the long blonde hair. Donatella Versace has stepped down as creative director of the fashion house that her brother founded, which she famously took over after his murder in 1997. As the House of Versace looks to changes in the future, we asked Robin Givhan to describe the impact Donatella Versace had on the business. Givhan is a critic at large for The Washington Post.
You know, they were very close. And, you know, for the fashion world, she was sort of the one who had kind of inspired and took the helm of the secondary line, which was called Versus. So when he died and it was announced that she was going to step up, it wasn't surprising in the sense that they were quite close, but it was surprising because it was such an enormous undertaking.
Right. I mean, what was she facing and how did she stick to her brother's vision? And in what ways did she chart her own path?
You know, the brand was really known for walking this fine line between sexy and vulgar. And when you're on the right side of that line, it can be incredibly exciting and provocative. When Donatella took over, she did shift the sensibility a bit. And it was, I would say, more feminine. It was a bit softer. And I would say, rather than necessarily being sort of sexy, it was sensual.
You know, typically what we've seen at the helm of luxury fashion labels are men. Gianni, of course, her late brother, Giorgio Armani, Yves Saint Laurent, Karl Lagerfeld. How unusual has it been to have a woman running a very important fashion house?
It has been, sadly, very unusual. It is not the norm to see a woman helming as the creative director of one of these luxury fashion houses. And, you know, and I have to say that when she showed that very first collection right after her brother died, clearly there was a lot of attention, a lot of eyeballs, you know, waiting to see how she would do. And it was really lovely to see the way that the fashion industry in general rallied around her, her brother's former colleagues. And I think people were cheering for her. And I think she rose to the occasion in many ways. And so it is disappointing that, you know, she didn't sort of open this floodgate of more female creative directors. You know, the lasting impact is really that she stepped in and she allowed this brand that was so closely associated with the family to continue under very difficult circumstances. And I think that she was also able to put her stamp on it without losing, as what the fashion industry loves to refer to as, the brand DNA.
There's speculation that Versace's holding company may actually opt to sell it. What kind of additional shift could we be seeing for the company?
This is really a season of upheaval and turmoil and musical chairs with the fashion industry. I mean, we have seen so many changes in creative directors. Just recently, you know, it was announced that the creative director of Balenciaga was moving to Gucci. So I think all of these brands are in a bit of creative upheaval. And I think a lot of that creative upheaval is because of economic woes.
Robin Givon is a critic at large for The Washington Post.
Germans are the world champions of calling in sick, so says the CEO of one of Germany's biggest companies, Allianz Insurance. He famously complained earlier this year that Germany's sick leave had gotten out of control. That set off a huge debate in the country about how much paid sick leave is too much, the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Jeremy Edwards is American. His wife, Sarah, is German. They live in Germany. And they make TikTok videos about culture shock. With this whole sick leave debate going on in Germany, this one grabbed my attention.
I can't go to work, but I know I have to.
Why?
I don't have any sick leave yet.
And you, what?
In Germany, if you feel sick, you stay home. On the fourth day, you need to get a doctor's note, but other than that, you get 6 weeks of sick leave at your full salary, paid for by your employer, after that health insurance kicks in. When Jeremy moved to Germany, he was shocked by how easy it was.
It's unbelievable to me, but it makes for a better relationship between people and their place of business and where they work at, where they feel comfortable enough to feel like, you know, if I'm sick, I don't have to necessarily force myself to go back to work like they kind of make you do in the U.S.
Here, the good thing is, even like if you call, you know, your doctor and or you're at the doctor's and you're just saying like, hey, you know what, I feel really overworked or I'm just like mentally not good enough, you also get on sick leave for that.
And if you get sick on vacation, you don't have to take a vacation day. You get that time back. Germany has one of the most generous sick pay systems in the world, and German workers are taking advantage of it. On average, they take 20 sick days a year compared to 8 for the rest of the EU. It's costing businesses a lot, says Nicholas Siebart at the Leibniz Center for European Economic Research.
When you just do some basic calculation, the 6 weeks of sick pay by the employer costs 80 billion. So the employer associations are claiming that's too much.
Employers are getting creative. Tesla and Mercedes-Benz, for example, are trying out incentive programs offering bonuses to employees that take less sick leave. There are also reports of bosses hiring private detectives to make sure employees are actually sick when they say they are. Tesla Germany sent managers to people's homes to see if they were faking. Now employers want to change the law. In that interview where CEO Oliver Bata called Germans the champions of sick leave, he also said it was time to make some cuts to the system. He doubled down a few weeks later at Davos.
We have created a society where you as an individual can make a decision where the cost of that decision is borne by everybody else, but not by yourself. Anybody who studied economics and social sciences for 1,000 years knows these systems cannot prevail.
Bata said the first day of sick leave should be unpaid. He claimed this would save businesses $40 billion a year. Britain and Spain have something like that, and actually Germany did too, but then they changed the law in the 1970s so sick workers could get paid from day one. Nicholas Seabart says he can't see the government going back. A more realistic proposal might be something they already do in Nordic countries, which is partial sick leave.
When somebody has depression, for example, and you want to reintegrate them slowly, or somebody can work from home 4 hours instead of 8, doctors can prescribe 50% sick days.
A system like that, he says, is more flexible, better suited to a world where more people work from home. He doubts there's the political will for anything more drastic. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
A very troubling report has just come out after a United Nations investigation into allegations that the Israeli security forces, comprising the Israel Defense Forces and police, have committed widespread sexual and gender-based violence against Palestinians. The investigation was carried out by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. We turn now to the findings of that report. Some of them are so disturbing that we're going to steer around the worst accounts. All the same, please take care while listening. Chris Sidoti is a UN commissioner who was part of the inquiry. We reached him in Geneva.
The big picture is that we found a widespread pattern of significant sexual violence directed in different ways at women and girls and at men and boys, and also targeting reproductive rights. And so the capacity of Palestinian women to produce babies, basically. This was certainly very extreme in Gaza, but also present in the West Bank, and as I say, was both widespread and seemed to be a consistent pattern of activities across the area.
So how did you go about looking into the claims that you kind of came across? What was the methodology?
Methodology starts with speaking to victims and witnesses. So amongst the witnesses, in fact, were many foreign, that is non-Palestinian, non-Israeli, doctors and medical experts who have done periods of weeks as volunteers in hospitals in Gaza. And they were able to report to us on what they see, on the nature of the injuries that women suffered and the problems in the treatment system. We have collected an enormous quantity of digital evidence, photographic and video evidence. I don't think there has ever been a period of warfare where so many soldiers from both sides have posted so much video and photographic material on the web.
Your report says the sexual violence has become systematic and that it's, quote, deliberate. Explain what that means.
What it means is that it's now so widespread and the nature of it is so consistent, so similar or really the same, that we have to form a conclusion that it's intentional and that it's part of a systematic policy as to how to treat people. And perhaps the best example of that is the practice of forced stripping of detainees and holding them for very long periods of time, either naked or near naked. The excuse given publicly by the Israelis for this is that it's necessary to strip search detainees to ensure they don't have any weapons. Now, that may be legitimate and lawful, but it's not lawful then to hold them for 3 days in that condition. There can be no security reasons for doing that.
I was going to say, I mean, there are even more troubling anecdotes in the report, even evidenced on social media of what happened to Palestinian women. The report says the Israeli government and the IDF managed to mobilize troops and the country to, if I interpret it correctly, essentially exact revenge for the Hamas abuse of women they abducted or killed on October 7th.
When we looked at these kinds of practices, we had to ask ourselves what could be the basis for this. And we asked experts, and we were told the allegations of sexual violence, which in many cases we found established against Israeli women on 7th October 23, caused the Israeli military to adopt a policy of inflicting sexual humiliation on Palestinian men and boys and women and girls. But there are other reasons too. Another one is the lack of accountability.
You're saying there's no accountability whatsoever?
There is no accountability whatsoever, except in very rare cases where the accountability is minimal. There was a case that became quite notorious because of video evidence of a Palestinian detainee being raped in the military detention centre of Sde Tamim. That resulted in such an outcry, including in Israel, because the videos went on Israeli TV and people were shocked that Israeli forces would act like this. 10 Israeli soldiers were investigated. In the end, 5 have been charged. But the 5 soldiers who have been charged have not been charged with any form of sexual assault.
What have you heard from the Israeli government about this report?
We've heard nothing from either the Israeli Defense Forces or the Israeli government. There were comments on X today by Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, and by Gantz, the former Defense Minister. All of those statements reject the report. We give them our reports in draft form about a month before they're released, and we do not hear anything. If they had real, genuine concerns about the accuracy of what we're saying, they have an opportunity to correct the facts.
Chris Sidoti is a commissioner with the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. We reached out to the Israel Defense Forces for comment on the UN findings. They referred us to the Prime Minister's office. So far, no reply.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A pygmy pipe horse, a guitar shark, an octocoral. We are not making these up. They are some of the more than 800 new marine species recently identified in the Global Ocean Census. Scientists are 2 years into a 10-year project to solve some of the mystery around the critters living in the world's oceans. And there still is a lot of mystery. Only about 10% of all marine life has been identified. Michelle Taylor is a scientist at the University of Essex working with the Ocean Census, and she's on an expedition looking for new creatures in the Southern Ocean right now.
I'm currently floating just off Saunders Island in the South Sandwich Islands in Antarctica. There is another UK research vessel nearby, but other than those, the closest people to me right now are those on the International Space Station.
So you and your collaborators are 2 years into this ocean census, and you found more than 800 species. Can you tell me about a few of the most outstanding or interesting?
You mentioned some of them. So sea butterflies are midwater animals, and they're very, very small. And they have a hard center, like a small shell, but they actually have these big flamboyant wings, these very soft wings that they use to float through the water. And because they're so soft-bodied, it's sometimes very difficult to isolate them and catch them. So that's a real find. That's something quite special.
Obviously, this is fascinating, and I can understand the appeal of discovering these new species, but why is it important to get a better understanding of the sea and deep sea, you know, to folks living very, very far from those oceans?
Yeah, I mean, species designation has a real importance. You know, you can target conservation efforts, you can target management efforts if you know that this one section of life is a different species from another section of life. In a purely, you know, almost human selfish sense, marine species are used in everyday medicines. Compounds from them are used in cancer treatments, they're used in pain relief. So if we're finding these species and bringing them into the light, literally from the depths in the darkness in the depths, is something that could be really important for humans and our existence.
I imagine there's better technology to do this type of discovery than ever before. Can you talk a little bit about how the ocean census is different than previous attempts to catalog ocean life?
Yeah, so the technology on board is extraordinary. So the Sebastian, which is the name of the remotely operated vehicle that we've been using, can go all the way down to 6,500 meters and very carefully select animals that we see through the 5K video footage that it produces. And that means that taxonomists can be really selective and, you know, as minimally invasive as possible. And it also means that you get to see them in life. So what often happens in traditional deep sea exploration is you use a trawl or you use a net, and the animals can come up and they've been quite battered and bruised, whereas these ones are exactly in their environment. They're in the habitat that they exist in, and they're interacting with the things around them in the way that they would. And that's really informative. So, for example, one of the animals that I found new to science a few weeks ago on this expedition, it was the way that the polyps were moving. It was the way that the parts of this animal were moving in the water that I thought, wow, I've never seen that before. And that's, you know, that, and I've been studying these animals for 15 years.
What does that feel like to see and then describe a brand new creature for the first time?
Oh, I don't think there's a buzz quite like it. I mean, it takes a lot of reading of 18th century German literature, because that's what all of the other descriptions of these species in this area were originally in. So it's a labor of love to understand what animals are out there already, so that when you come across something new, you know it.
This research is being funded in part by the Nippon Foundation, which also funds exploration for marine mining and is involved with offshore oil and gas extraction. Will this research be used for that?
Oh, I had no idea about that. So, no, I didn't know.
So you don't know if your research will be used for eventually looking for minerals to mine or places to drill oil?
I mean, I very much doubt it, because it's all the information that we found out about the deep sea so far is that it's more diverse than we imagined.
What do you think your research will lead to?
So I personally study corals, and corals have got an incredible array of compounds in them. So my research will be contributing towards biodiversity assessments in this area. It will contribute towards how the UK government manages this area. And once you understand that this species exists and it has a place in our collective knowledge, that's where so many other fields of research can kick in. Once the specimens that we collect are in an institute and preserved there in that way, the world is your oyster, the world is your lobster. You can use that research in so many different ways.
Michelle Taylor is a scientist at the University of Essex, talking with me from a ship in Antarctica.
Despite what we're often told in folktales, sometimes it's not so bad to bump into an evil spirit. Or so producer Phil Corbett tells us in this audio postcard from Nepal.
There is a demon on the stage. It's a hot night in Kathmandu, Nepal, and long hair violently whips around. The demon's red face is split by an unnerving smile. Surrounding it is a group of percussionists performing a new version of an old ritual. Drums, cymbals, a large flute, and interestingly, an electric guitar. The name of this ancient Nepalese demon is Lakhe, and the name of the heavy metal band surrounding it is also Lakhe, a metal band that uses traditional instruments. In addition to the physical drums being made of goat leather and wood, the drum beats are traditional, too. So that's the basic drum beat. Then the electric guitar mimics it. And finally, they mix it together with the cymbals, and you get this. And with that, like a spell, the demon comes alive.
Wow. Postcards from the Wind are produced by Phil Corbett. You can hear more stories at thewind.org.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Cindy and Dan Lothian, Serena Altschul, Kamrudin Mithani, Jane Johnson, Elizabeth Hansen and Jake Shapiro, and Alyssa and Mike Wilson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.